We're going to cover chapters 8 through 13 of Robert Capers' book, The Immaterial Facts. I will leave out chapter 12. Chapter 8 is really the high point of the introductory chapters, identification and the structure of the inner world. Part of the problem that Freud and his key co-worker, Carl Abraham, who worked out of Berlin while Freud was in Vienna, part of what they worked with all the time and didn't have a good answer to was what we would now call depression. Depression's not a modern occurrence. If you look back in literature and history, there are plenty of literary examples of people being described who fit perfectly in what we would consider a modern pattern of depression. Many folks thought that it was impossible to treat because they had never had any success treating it. They didn't understand what it was. Many folks historically thought you were possessed by demons. Some people thought you were just lazy and immoral and bad seed. And there wasn't anything that could be done about it. It was just genetic. It was inherited. You know, if your dad was bad, you were bad. That's just the way things were. Freud and Abraham said, there's something else going on here that we have to understand. And in his great book, Mourning and Melancholia, 1917, Freud, I'm on page 17 of the notes now, Freud described the difference between what we would call sadness, normal grieving in a difficult life where loss is not unusual, and melancholia. That's what we would now call depression. And one of my frustrations with the modern media, I don't mean to pick on Oprah Winfrey, but let's pick on Oprah Winfrey. Her vision seems to think that every pain is pathology. That every time someone's frustrated or angry or sad, they need to be medicated. I don't know if that's true, but I get the impression from the few times I've seen her that that's the way she thinks about things. That every pain is pathology and medication is the right way to go. And Freud said, absolutely not. That there are some things in life, lots of things in life, that are painful, that we just have to manage, process, deal with, work through. Those who can do that well, who can achieve a sense of grieving that's a healthy and appropriate response to a loss that can be endured, come out the other side just fine most of the time. Who in their lives, who in their childhoods, do not experience loss of some kind? The truth was, Freud and Abraham recognized that weaning off of the breast in infancy is the first tragic, traumatic loss that a child has to handle. And very often accompanied by other experiences of loss of the mother, loss of nurturing care, loss of a present containing experience of the mother and or father. These things, at that stage, are traumatic, are difficult to process. If I wear out my favorite pair of shoes, that's a loss. I can live through it. I don't become depressed. I'll miss them. I'll think about them now and then and remember the good times, how comfortable they were and how good they made me look. But I'm not going to go into a fit of depression over a worn-out pair of shoes. That's at one end of the extreme. The baby, perhaps abandoned too soon, perhaps taken off the breast before the experience of that loss could be processed, managed, perhaps having it done in a family environment where they could not experience it and have someone take that pain away from them. But then I think most of our parents have failed frequently to allow us to experience pain, because a child in pain tears the heart out of most parents. We hate seeing our children in pain. Instead of helping the child work through the pain, we frequently overreact and say, "Don't cry." Guys, especially, how many times did your father, or even your mother, when you were little, you don't cry, boys don't cry. Come on, you know, that's enough. Toughen up a little bit. Okay? Those kind of messages tell the child that their emotional response is wrong, that somehow they're bad, inappropriate. And the division between mourning and melancholia that Freud laid out in 1917, I think remains a valid attempt to understand what we in the modern era consider depression. And here's how we thought about it. Depression linked to identification. This is subtle. Remember identification from the last lecture. This idea that our experiences with our earliest caregivers don't just teach us by observation, by monitoring what's going on and thinking about how to mimic them, by copying them, modeling. We see the modeling behavior and when we reproduce it. We may think in language, get taught lessons in language. That's not what Freud's talking about here. Identification is that accumulation of experience, that taking in of not just what was being taught, but the entire relational dynamic in the maternal and paternal environment. I don't just take in the lessons of my father. I take in my father and my mother. When I feel guilt, Freud identified the superego as being a result of identification with the experience of a father, and I think a mother, in laying down the rules. And when you feel guilty, it is not the memory of punishment that affects you. It's the internalized wagging finger of the law-giving father that now you have inside you. You are now punishing yourself. Guilt is the self-punishment inflicted on the self by the internalized objects that you identified with in your childhood. This is actually a good thing. It's the only way we can keep people civilized, is if we have them internalize the experience of the rules of society. It's not a bad thing. It's a perfectly normal and appropriate thing, a necessary thing. But it can also, like most normal things, go wrong. And Freud thought about depression this way. And I see this all the time in my patients. What happens if a child experiences a loss that's too traumatic and too intense and too overwhelming emotionally for them to manage by themselves? For example, you know, the parent slaps them around or neglects them or is bad in some way that's relatively serious. And the child can't handle it. They have one choice. And they have one choice only when you're very young. The choice is simple. Either my parents are evil, or it's my fault, I'm bad. Which is the obvious choice? No child can come to the first conclusion, even when it's true, perhaps especially when it's true, because that would mean their annihilation. The child must at some level recognize that if their parents are bad, evil, destructive, negligent, their very life is at risk. That kind of anxiety will make you psychotic. So they turn the anger, and Freud was very clear, when you've got sadness, when you've got depression, what's right underneath the depression? Anger. Every time. Because what he thought was, when children are neglected or abused or hurt, or they experience a loss at their parents' hands that they can't handle, they're naturally angry at the parents. But they can't be. Because it's too dangerous to be angry at the parents. So where does the anger go? It comes back against the self. And Freud said that depression is just anger turned against the self. Instead of saying, Dad, you're bad. You're a bad father. I don't like what you're doing. You're hurting me. Oh, it's my fault. I'm bad. I'm the guilty one. I'm the bad son. I shouldn't have done that. It's all my fault. And of course, if you take that in, if that's the experience you identify with, it's the very definition of depression. You feel like you are hopeless, worthless, helpless, bad, guilty. Those are the words used in the diagnostic manual as diagnostically significant experiences for a depressed person. If you have those, you are likely to be depressed. But think about how it happens. Think about where we are now in the flow of psychology. We are no longer in the psychology of a mind driven like some hydraulic machine. We're not talking about neuronal dislocation or discharge or buildup or broken neurons in a brain somewhere. We're talking about a purely psychological experience in a relationship that begins at a very young age. And the ramifications of not being able to process loss, the anger in the face of loss we cannot handle, then turned back against the self. When Freud says the shadow of the object falls upon the ego, I mean, it's almost poetic. He doesn't use a lot of technical jargon in this section. It's the shadow of the object. So, you know, you can imagine the big punitive father figure internalized, identified with, in the unconscious, in the object relations, and my little ego with that shadow leaning, you know, laying across it, affecting it in a powerful way. Basically, you know, I'm the bad one. That's depression. Now, I have to be honest, that is the position of about half of the psychological community. The other half says, oh, it's a brain chemistry problem that needs medication to readjust the brain chemistry. You couldn't get two more different ways of thinking about depression. Pure biology, pure brain chemistry, pure relational dynamics, unconscious psychology. Relational dynamics throughout the child's life, loss as it relates to early childhood experiences. Right, that is probably right now the biggest conflict in psychology, and as a psychology instructor, I've got to be honest that right now we're about split 50-50 down the middle. Do psychotropic medications help depression? Yes. I have many patients on medication right now, and it's doing them a world of good. Here's the way I think about it, and I want to be very clear that a lot of people think very differently, and this is, I'm not going to test you on my personal theory of depression. The spectrum is very wide here. But to me, it's a little like if I break my arm and I go to the emergency room, they give me morphine, I hope. And at that point, I'm fine. I feel great. I'm in no pain. Matter of fact, I feel better than I did before I broke my arm. And I leave because I'm fine now, right? No, I got a broken arm. The morphine, like the antidepressant medication, fixes not the problem, but the symptom. Now, that can be important. I've had patients who absolutely could not get to my office. I had this one woman in particular. She was on a cocktail of antipsychotic, anti-anxiety, antidepressive, and a couple of other medications. And she couldn't get out of bed in the morning almost without them all. And I said, take them all, take extras. I didn't say take extras. Take what you need to get you to my office so we can do the work that's the equivalent of setting the bone, fixing the actual problem, not just dealing with the symptoms. And one of the reasons I come to that conclusion is because the literature is clear. If you stop taking your antidepressant medications, you very often plummet down into a depression as bad and sometimes worse than you were in before you started the medication. It's very clear to me, at least, that it's symptom relief. And again, that can be very important. But it doesn't fix the problem, and who wants to be on medication for the rest of your life? You can't really anyway, because like many other substances, heroin, cocaine, alcohol, the body develops a tolerance to any kind of medication, and pretty soon it doesn't work as well as it used to. So my advice is this way of thinking, and ways like it, I think lay out a way in conjunction with medication, if it's appropriate, to really fix the problem. So Donovan Bigelow's vision. And it started with Freud in 1917. But again, the key here for purposes of our perspective is that, bottom of page 17, we're no longer talking about the discharge of libido. All right, we're talking about identification, internalizing the persecuting object. How does a baby feel when the breast is taken away? Before they want it to be, before they're okay with it being taken away? It's an angry-making thing. It's a painful thing. It's a loss and a frustration. And they're angry. I mean, most women have an experience with, when they take the breast away, if they give it back, it's often bitten. There's an angriness in some of these children. One of my favorite examples, I may have mentioned this before, a woman in the back of a class once was a relatively new mother, and she described her baby at one point. I think the baby was almost 2 years old, still breastfeeding, which is cool. And she said, and I asked, any mothers out here whose babies had bitten them? And I asked her, and she raised her hand, I said, what was in the baby's face when you looked at him as he was biting? And she said, right away, she said, evil. And she didn't mean evil. What she meant, smiling, was this baby was angry at me. This baby was furious at me. It wasn't biting accidentally. It was intentional. And I think she recognized what Klein recognized, that the baby's minds, and we'll come back to this a little later, the baby's minds are filled with intense emotion, filled with intense devotion, love, desire, connection, anger, frustration, hatred, rage. And it flips back and forth. You can see a baby turn it on and turn it off very quickly. They can go from peaceful and fine to all of a sudden they got a something going on inside them, and man, they turn red and they scream. And then very soon they're back. The swings are phenomenal. And Klein looked at babies the way Freud watched his adult patients. She took them seriously. She saw the looks in their faces. She saw the way they played. And she allowed herself to think about the possibility that what she was seeing really existed, that this level of intense emotion was something very real that the babies were having to deal with quite often without maternal help, because the mother simply couldn't imagine that much difficulty going on inside their babies, which of course made the problem worse. And hence, clients have always had depression, because so few of us have been able to get the help we need to manage the day-to-day losses of all of our lives. The good news is, if you can do that, if you can reconnect with a developmental process, if you have help in your current life when you lose something important, you need not plunge into the depths of depression. You get to take a breath, recognize in reality the nature of the loss, recognize that you are vulnerable to feelings of personal worthlessness, depression, which right below, of course, is the dangerous bit of anger. This happened yesterday in my treatment of a client of mine. He's been depressed for a long time. And he's got a unique and difficult relationship with both his mother and his father now. They've been divorced for 25 years. But in this particular instance, he was frustrated with his mother, who was disregarding his best interests, who was just sort of not paying attention to him again. And in the session, all of a sudden, much to his surprise and a little bit to mine, he came out with this, "How does she do that? It drives me insane. I hate her. How could she possibly not care that I'm suffering so much?" And he was just boiling over with rage. And I thought to myself without saying anything, this is an improvement. Because now the anger that has generated so much of his own self-destruction in his life is now finally coming out and going back where it belongs. With my help and containment, he doesn't say these things to her yet, because there probably wouldn't be any purpose to that. But at least he's not stuffing them now back into himself, where he then sort of ruminates on his worthless life. He's getting it out, and it's painful to watch. I tear up several times in his presence when it's so hard to see him experiencing what I think are the same emotions he felt as a 2-year-old baby, but couldn't get any help to process, so they had to be stuffed even quite early. In Kleinian terms, they had to be split and projected off. Now he's starting to get at it, and it's an amazing thing to watch, and I think his depression is lifting. He's now taking a much more joyous interest in life. He's working through some of these things in a way that makes sense. He's had a recent loss of a relationship, but it's not driving him into the depths of depression. He's managing it fairly well. So I think these ideas, specifically, I mean, Freud's 1917 book, to me, is one of the few things that Freud wrote that remains directly relevant to my work with clients now. And I think remains relevant to you. How many of you have lost something that sent you over the edge? How many of you have been dumped by a partner or a lover, or had a divorce, or lost a job, or lost a loved one to death or illness? What happens to you when that happens? You get very sad. But I think more specifically, you reenact losses that you experienced in your earliest childhood. The style of your reaction to loss gets laid down very, very early. Okay. So that's what identification can do when perhaps it goes wrong. Freud's talking about how identification might be the center of mental development. That it's in these experiences with your key caregivers, that you take in these experiences, you identify with your mother, your father, the other key people in your life, but mainly your mother and father. And it is that vehicle of identification that is the building blocks, these object relationships, these experiences that are accumulated, that you take in constantly in your childhood, and I think through adolescence, and frankly, I don't think it ever stops. I think important people in your lives, as an adult, have the ability for you to take in experiences with them that's quite profound. You all know someone who, as an adult, turns their life around. How did that happen? Many times it's because they found a mentor, they found a teacher, they found a spiritual advisor, they found a lover, they found a partner who helped them. But isn't it always because they were in connection with someone else who helped them? How many people do you know who turn their life around all by themselves? It almost never happens. If you look at it closely, you find that it's in connection. And I think that's the same dynamic that a child uses to grow their own mind. We still grow our minds that way. It takes love to help your mind grow as a baby, and I think also as an adult. That's the theory. In Freud's words, adult mental development is a history of object choices. Now, children don't make choices about their parents, of course, but I think what he means by that is that we can see in every one of us, if you take your own history, if you think back for 2 minutes over your life, almost inevitably you are thinking back over your relationships. It's the people in your life who are the signposts of your development, almost always. Yes, there can be things that happened that are important. Of course, you get hit by lightning, that's important. But I suspect the next thing you'll remember if you've been hit by lightning is who you were there with. I think Freud was onto something, that his became a relational... The development of the human mind became primarily for him, at this stage of his game, not a biological thing, though that remained, I think, bedrock, but primarily a relationship thing. The result of internalized, identified with relationships that were taken into the mind, and in that object relational matrix, there's your identity. This is well beyond id, ego, and superego. It's almost like id, ego, and superego are the structure, the infrastructure, the superstructure of a building. And these fantasies, these object relationships, fill it up, give the substance, the style to each of our personalities. All right. And then he suggests that this was the precursor, this was the lead up to the resolution of the Oedipus complex, without which we were all in some trouble. We'll come back to that a little bit later. Okay. Chapter 9, Anxiety and the Structure of the Inner World. This is probably my favorite part of the history of psychology, because what we have here in chapter 9 is a short description of how Freud was writing. And he writes this book in 1926, Inhibitions, Symptoms, and Anxiety. And it's a mess to read. It's a mess. He's all over the place. He's bouncing around. It doesn't flow very well. He adds three appendix to try to explain stuff. It's a mess. Now, Freud was a pretty careful writer. He got awards for writing. But what you see in this particular text was how terribly confusing it was, and how he struggled with trying to make sense of stuff that he thought he'd understood, but it turns out clinical data showed he was wrong. And on page 104, you have this most amazing paragraph. At the age of 70, Freud had to face the fact that his libido theory of anxiety, an important part of the psychical physical model to which he still half hoped to return, was no longer secure. Okay, he's 70 years old, folks. He'd worked for 50 years in this field. And he takes a big, deep breath one day and says, oops, for much of my life, I have been wrong. Okay, how do we fix it? Who could do that? How many of your parents, how many of your grandparents are so dyed in the wool, so stuck in their paradigm, that at age 70 they can take a deep breath and change things dramatically about their belief systems that they've had for 50 years? It's an astonishing exercise, and I think intellectual integrity. At the bottom of page 105, he says, it is almost humiliating that after working so long, we should still have difficulty in understanding the most fundamental facts. But we have made up our minds to simplify nothing and to hide nothing. If we cannot see things clearly, we will at least see clearly what the obscurities are. This is one of the humblest things I've ever read. This guy's worked for 50 years. At this stage of the game, he is world famous. There's nobody in the world more famous than Freud at this point in time, with the possible exception of Albert Einstein. Okay? Muhammad Ali hadn't been around yet. That's a bad joke. Never mind. All right. So he admits that it's humiliating to have to reconsider almost everything, and he has the moral courage to say, you know what? I may not know the truth. I may not know the truth at all, but one of the things I'm going to try to do for the next generation is at least show them where I have failed. Show them what the complexities are. show them the problems I could not handle and wish them well trying to handle them, is effectively what he's saying here. It's remarkable. A remarkable exercise and, I think, profound courage. And, of course, what he was talking about was his fundamental theory that repression causes anxiety. And he realizes, no, I was wrong. I got it exactly the opposite. Not just wrong, the opposite of what I've been struggling with for decades. Anxiety causes repression, not the other way around. All right? Not repressed libido, but defenses against anxiety are what is causing most of his patients all of their trouble. And this sets up a completely different way of thinking about the mind. Right? The force behind the neurosis was an anxiety stemming from an internal threat to a relationship within the mind between the ego and the superego, which is exactly what I've been saying. That's what he meant. That's a little bit technical language, I'm sorry. But what he means very clearly is that this process of identification, this taking in of experience, has set up conflicts between the experiences themselves, some of which are contradictory. And of course, your own defenses and your own instincts and impulses, all of this is mixed up inside your psychic reality, leading to tremendous conflicts and generating anxiety. It's fascinating stuff. Identification forms the superego, but aggression adds an element. All right, so this is where he gets the final hint. Think of all the material we've worked through so far. He discovers the transference in the Dora case. He discovers at least the beginnings of a new way of thinking about anxiety in the little Hans case. He recognizes the importance of identification. All of a sudden he realizes there's more going on than biology here, that the meaning of some of these things to the person in their unconscious, and even he called used the word fantasies, somehow has some profound power and control over how we relate in the world and who we are. And then he realizes, chapter 10, he goes beyond Eros and realizes again in his 70s, a year before he died, in his early 80s, he says we must rethink almost everything in psychoanalysis because of our new understanding of the meaning of aggression. He missed aggression as a primary human motivation. He had been operating all this time thinking about sexuality, libido, the sexual responses and priorities in terms of mating. But he now sees, right at the end of his life, astonishingly, the powerful input of aggression as a separate dynamic. And of course, this was the thing that I think, personally, that I think Klein took and ran with. If you get analyzed by a Kleinian, oh my God, they beat you over the head with aggression. They are focused on that in ways that I think show Klein just took what Freud had right at the end even and ran with it. And of course, because he remained a scientist, he got aggression wrong in large part. He was confused by it. He wasn't sure. It was new to him in this way of thinking. He called it the destructive instinct. He called it the death instinct. He called it the aggressive instinct. He didn't know what the hell to call it, apparently. And for a lot of folks, his use of the phrase the death instinct was a problem. Because especially now, after 30 years of evolutionary psychology and a deeper understanding of genetics than he ever could have had, we recognize that a death instinct is not possible. Why? Simple. If I have, remember evolutionary psychology, variation, inheritance, selection, the key elements of genetic change, a variation in a random variation in a genetic structure that's inheritable, that has an adaptive advantage in a particular environment. If I have a death instinct somehow, genetically based, and I have a little more of it than my neighbors, what happens? Like anything in genetics, if it has an adaptive advantage, it survives. Tall people on the African plain, remember, they survive better if they're tall. Therefore, they're all tall. Why? Because the short ones have been eaten by lions. Well, if there's a death instinct, wouldn't you think that it would, let me think, die out faster? And of course, that's correct. So the idea of a death instinct that's a biological thing is simply impossible, given our current understanding of how genetics work. So most people now don't agree that Freud's tentative hypothesis of a death instinct holds much water anymore. A few do, but not many. What we do recognize, and interesting, I teach American history, and I teach contemporary world issues. And you don't have to read much history, or you don't have to look around the world much, to realize that aggression is dominating. All right, you don't have to be a big historian to realize that the human's ability to kill and maim and destroy is astonishing, to the point where it's shocking to me that it took Freud this long to get aggression. And what's interesting, and what I think, my own personal speculation, is that, remember, he left for England in about 1936. He died in 1938, right after the Nazis took over and had begun their program. And I think, it's hard for me not to believe that his witnessing the terror of violence at that Nazi level didn't have some effect on the way he was thinking. All of his sisters were murdered in concentration camps. His own daughter, Anna Freud, was interrogated by the Gestapo several times at length and unpleasantly. He was saved just because of his international notoriety, and he didn't want to leave. He was finally prevailed on to leave by most of his students, who begged for him to come to England and save himself. He only survived another 2 years. But it's hard for me not to imagine that experience didn't have some effect on his thinking. Be that as it may, the idea of aggression as a part of a dual instinct theory, sexuality and aggression, explaining human behavior much better than just sexuality alone. I think that was his final contribution in terms of understanding human mental functioning. Okay, so let's move on to chapter 11, the second part of the text, Melanie Klein's development of Freud's work. Now, Klein began, and I think remains most famous, for her work with children. And what's fascinating to writers is that she came after Freud and couldn't have come before Freud, but it's a little ironic that the work with children had to come after that of adults. And it probably wouldn't have been possible for Klein to do what she did with children if Freud hadn't done what he'd done with adults and speculated about how child development works. It's Freud laying down this genetic theory of child development, this stage theory of child development, which we now accept universally, maybe not the particular stages, but certainly the facts of development and the stage theory of development is now unquestioned in child development circles. It was Klein who took the ideas that Freud laid out, all of the ideas, transference, unconscious fantasy, identification, the sources and power of anxiety, internal structures and fantasy, and then applied them to children in her play therapy, which is a technique she developed herself. And what she discovered was that children playing with toys are astonishingly similar to adult patients who are free associating. And in fact, they're actually better at it than adults are, because adults have been trained to lie, to hide, to pretend, to deny. They're good at their defense mechanisms that keep them from the truth of their own mind. But you know what? Little children are really lousy liars most of the time. If they feel something, they just say it most of the time until they're inhibited from doing so. And so Klein had the advantage of being able to use Freud's ideas and apply them to children, and what she saw was astonishing. Again, the idea that children's minds are complicated, that they're filled with intense emotions, they're filled with feelings across the full spectrum of emotional experience, from the most intimate, deep, and devoted love to the most rageful hate imaginable. Okay. And the first thing Klein was concerned about was children's education. Now, if you think about a child like a tape recorder, you just tell them what to do, and they remember, and then they do it. You find yourself very frustrated with their learning. Klein said, learning. And I think, I don't know if I got this from her or not, but I've put up on the board several times for you this idea of biology as the bedrock, then emotion, then thinking, then creativity. Okay? She got very quickly that unless the child's emotional dynamics were stable, contained, managed. The child's ability to think later was severely inhibited. And here's the connection that I want to make from the previous lectures. This is so important. Klein recognized that unless you successfully went through the Oedipus complex, unless your developmental process was good enough, to use the Winnicott idea, unless you had an adequate, good enough maternal and paternal experience who would help you manage your anxiety, who you could identify with and take in not just a punitive superego, but one that was nurturing and supportive, if you could take in your sense of identity as whole and healthy and loved and lovable, then you could think. Then you could learn. And if you didn't, you couldn't. Klein is suggesting, completely counter to the modern idea of learning disabilities, that there is no such thing as a learning disability in and of itself, as if you had a flu-like symptom involved in your ability to cognitively process information. She's saying that the emotional containment is the necessary prerequisite for the ability to think at all. And you all know in some way this is true. Have you ever been scared? I mean, really scared of something? How well do you think? Fear freezes thinking. Deer in the headlights. You get scared. You freeze. I think the exact same things happen to children. If they're too drenched in their own fantasies of persecutory anxiety, if their lives aren't contained and protected and safe enough, then they're always wondering when the next shoe is going to fall. They're always afraid, is Dad coming home angry again? And oh my God, we know what happens when that happens. Is Mom stable today? Or is she going to be in one of her moods? If the child is thinking about managing their own anxiety so much, where is the learning possible? It isn't. I think that our medication of adolescent boys today in junior high schools is a travesty. It's an admission of our manifest failure to parent these boys in an acceptable way, acceptable in terms of their own developmental needs. There's plenty of, this is another thing where the field is in complete conflict. It's a little like the causes and treatment of depression. Is ADHD a function of brain chemistry disorders that needs to be medicated? Or is it, like Klein is suggesting, the acting out of an object relationship? Is it the acting out of a sense of identity too drenched in anxiety to be able to think or sit still? She makes a persuasive argument, at the very least, that those things should be looked at seriously before we start dropping chemicals down kids' heads. That's the argument. Basically, a healthy resolution of the Oedipus complex is the necessary prerequisite for learning all the way along. And here's the extra point that's critical. What happens in the Oedipus complex? It's the beginnings of, maybe not the beginnings, maybe it's the culmination of a process of sexual curiosity, of boys learning that they're boys and girls learning that they're girls, and the major identifications with the same-sex parent, same-gendered parent. And the wondering what's going on, the trying to learn about themselves, trying to learn about what's going on behind the bedroom door. That first need to know stuff, how is that handled by the parents? If that curiosity is fostered, then the tendency is to have a lifelong experience of the goodness of learning, of the usefulness of learning. I'm empowered by my learning. But if the Oedipus complex is not handled appropriately, if a child's curiosity about their bodies, about relationships, about where babies come from, if that is punished or inhibited or restricted or repressed in all of the incredible ways parents have of doing that, then the take-home lesson for the child is being curious is dangerous. And there's your learning disorder. It's not about a failure to process cognitive data adequately at the brain level. It's about a fantasy of punishment if I want to know things I don't know. completely different ways of thinking about one of the most serious problems facing our adolescents today. All right, one technique thing about Klein that's interesting is that Freud was very careful. He didn't go down deeper than patients could handle. He thought that getting through the defenses a little bit at a time was necessary before we reached down and pulled out the most terrible of psychotic levels of anxiety. Klein didn't think so. Klein thought, go deeper, stay home, man. She wanted to interpret the most intense anxiety in the room at the moment. She would not pussyfoot around, and if you go see a Kleinian therapist today, just hang on, because it's going to be a wild ride. They will not hesitate to talk about, if you bring it into the room, if you reference it, if you provide a sense that something about your experience is accessing that intensity, man, they will go right after it. And in terms of both the anxiety and the aggression, it's quite intense and can be quite disturbing, actually. All right, top of page 21 of the notes. I'm sorry about the notation. At some point, these notes are not going to be on the right pages that I'm giving you. So here's the quote. A precondition for the psychoanalysis of a child is to understand and interpret the fantasies, feelings, anxieties, and experience expressed in play, or if play activities are inhibited, the causes of inhibition. Okay, folks, all she's saying here with this overly academic-sounding language is that if you're going to know somebody in your life, pick a loved one, pick a partner, pick a child or a parent, mainly pick someone you're close to right now, an intimate partner. If you want to know them, if you want to really know them, do you catalog a checklist of their various preferences on things to do or things to eat? Do you think you know them if you know what they want to do on Friday night? Klein says no. What are their fantasies? Both conscious fantasies. What makes up their identity? How do they react to anxiety? What patterns do they relate to in terms of their relationships? How do they experience conflict, fear, danger? What is the meaning of love to them at this level? If you can figure that out, then you know someone. And I think that's what it means when a mother and father know a child. They've spent enough time with them. They understand them at this level. And Klein says it's important to be able to analyze them. But I think what she means here really is this is what a mother and father must do to love their child. Children need to be raised. They don't just grow up. They need parents that understand what their fear means, to understand what their anger actually means, and how to respond to it in ways that nurture their growth. Most mothers know the meaning of their baby's crying. Most mothers will tell you very quickly that their child has 3 or 4 or 5 different cries. The I'm cold cry, I'm scared cry, I'm hungry cry, I have diaper rash cry. And the mothers are very attuned to that. More so than the fathers, quite clearly, it seems to me. I want to take that and expand it. I think those kind of intuitive understandings of these kind of things, the fantasies, the feelings, the anxieties, the meaning of those external behaviors to the child, to know those is to love. Everything else is superficial. That's the door that Klein opened up. Okay, that's the door that Freud opened up, that Klein walked through, or kicked in, maybe better. All right, a couple of things. Child's inner world, the psychic reality of the Brothers Grimm. I got to talk about this for a few minutes. Who are the Brothers Grimm? They're a German couple of writers who 300 years ago wrote fairy tales, and you've all heard of them. Little Red Riding Hood, Jack and the Beanstalk, Hansel and Gretel, Snow White, etc., etc., etc. But you know, I've got them in there. I've got the originals in my office. Do you know what those things are really like? This isn't the Disney movie, folks. In the Little Red Riding Hood, oh my God, they describe the hunter gutting the wolf and the blood. And in Little Red Riding Hood, in Hansel and Gretel, they burn the witch up in the oven, and it's graphic. I mean, it's not Saw 7, but wow! It's shockingly graphic. Why? I think the great literary writers recognize something profound. that until Klein we did, we lost. That it accurately reflects what's going on in the baby's and the young child's mind. They have those kind of fantasies of witches and monsters and terrible violence. Klein saw it in her infants and her young children's minds. And you can see it in children's minds if you look. And I think what happens is these fairy tales were written to help children work through their own fantasies. A little boy who's fighting the giant and sees a bedtime story where he actually outwits the giant and kills the giant and he's successful and he makes it home feels, yeah, I can do that. Hell, I'm doing that. It's an identification with the successful little warrior in him. And you notice one thing about these fairy tales? Where's mom during all these fairy tales? Where's dad? They're never there. Never does a mother or father make an appearance, almost never, in a fairy tale. You know why? Because they're the monsters. They're the witches. They're the ogres under the bridge that the children have to fight. That's the lesson of Kleinian understanding of children's minds. And that's reflected in the literature. And it works. It's intuitively empathic. It helps the child recognize that they're not alone, that their feelings aren't crazy. What happens when a child has those feelings and we show them Sesame Street and the Teletubbies? We make them crazy. We tell them the message we send them by allowing them to watch SpongeBob SquarePants is that your mind is bad, that you're crazy, dangerous, that your feelings are inappropriate.
Teletubby.
I'm going to take a position, probably get me in trouble. Letting your children watch SpongeBob SquarePants, the Teletubbies, or Sesame Street is child abuse. All, sorry, I'm going to get letters. I know I'm going to get letters. I'm going to get complaints. But I think if you don't understand what's going on in a child's mind, really, and that you project your own fear and weakness into the world and you want them only to be safe. But they're not safe inside their own minds because they feel this kind of hostility. They feel aggression. They have intense emotions. And to deny them a way to express them, to deny them an opportunity to identify with others who have the same feelings, who experience the same fears, leaves the young children painfully alone. And we do them no good if we do that to them. You know what? It's true for adult movies. Vampire movies, werewolf movies, the two archetypes. We see them all the time. Every 5 years, somebody comes out with a new vampire movie, a new werewolf movie. They've been doing it since the 1920s, since there have been movies. What do they represent? Why are they so successful? Why do this genre keep coming back? Why has it never died? Because I think it reflects something to adults that's identical to fairy tales for children. It represents something profoundly within us that we identify with, and we can't help but like it if it's done well. What does the werewolf represent? The werewolf always represents the id, violent aggression. The werewolf kills and destroys. The werewolf is an animal. Okay? And what happens in the end of most werewolf movies? It has to be killed. But then what happens? Then what do we realize? The magic bullet that kills it, usually not just a magic bullet, usually the heroism of the hero as well. And we see, and there's always the music at that point, the music that's sad and tragic. And we see the werewolf, the mean, evil, vicious monster, the violent murderer, slowly transform back into the poor man who we now feel sorry for. And it's all so sad. But that means that we identify with the werewolf in the man, that we recognize something of our own id in that character. But it has to be killed. It has to be contained. Society cannot let rampant aggression run loose. It has to be contained, and that's the story of the werewolf. But it's a story of all of us. And now, of course, we switch to vampires. What are vampires about? Always. Who? Almost every vampire character is the same. They, of course, are very sophisticated. They speak with an Eastern European accent. They always dress with a pocket handkerchief in a tuxedo, and they're very good with the ladies. Okay? And where do they attack the ladies? Always, always, always. In the bedroom. And of course, the ladies faint away and open their necks to them most of the time. Because a vampire is about what? Sex. Vampires are always about erotic experience. And every guy in the room wants to be the vampire to get the girl. And every girl's secretly neck is tingling a little bit when the vampire comes into the scene. And what happens at the end of the vampire movie? Stake through the heart. Because violence, sexuality, like violence, cannot run rampant. The id must be checked. The dual instincts, sex and aggression, must be contained, or all chaos breaks loose. Death and destruction. So the vampire must die. And it's the story that keeps getting told over and over, and we identify with the sexual intensity of the vampire. The desire for omnipotent control. Sexually, conquest. And the truth is, it'll never end. You want to make $1 million? You want to be rich? Tap into something primitive, primal, basic, fundamental, and portray it in an exciting, interesting way, and you will never lose money. Things that are fundamental about the human psyche, things that are fundamental about human nature, will always have a market if the technique of its presentation is competent and professional. Fantastic. So we have the top of page 22, the titanic struggle between love and hate in every child, and the repetition of that struggle in every adult. Folks, we keep doing the same thing. How much do you love? How much do you hate? How much is your life spent struggling with an attempt to contain hate, to find love, to deal with the loss of love, to avoid falling into depression, to stuff your anger against yourself, to try to get that out, and try it. There's a lady I just met. She's a worker, and she sends me an email. And then I get an email today from somebody else in her same office, and I thought, what's that about? And I go over to the office because I have to take some paper. And she said, I said, did you change your name? She said, yes, I got married. I said, well, congratulations. And she's about my age. Very, very old for most of the people. All right? And I said, good for you. Still struggling, still trying to, still hopeful. And, I mean, I got married 3 years ago. And that struggle, and it's beautiful, and it's wonderful, and I'm happier than I've ever been in my life. And the idea that this struggle never ends, that we don't stop trying to handle these fundamental things in our life, that Freud began trying to understand and Klein opened up with more specifics about childhood development. But the take-home lesson here is what they laid down is not ancient history of somebody else or not some theory. You really, if you take this stuff in and can manage to sort of hold it in mind and think about it, you may have opportunities to make differences in your life to contain your werewolves and manage your vampires and the other monsters in your life that haunted you as children, and I suspect still drive you to make repetitions of those early dynamics that cause you no end of trouble in your adult lives. Get a handle on that. Use this material. Apply that to yourself in some way. This isn't group therapy and it's not therapy, but this is psychology, and it ought to be about you, not about some academic welding discipline or nursing or physics or chemistry, which is always one or two steps removed. This, folks, is right. Is about all of you. So I hope that's useful, and we'll bring it to a close now, take a break, and drive on from there. Thank you very much. We're done. You know what? This shouldn't be a big shock, because, folks, how scary is dating for you as an adult? All right, you feel real comfortable on a first date? That's like a nightmare most of the time. First date, come on. Anxiety. It's drenched in sexual dynamics. Does he like me? Does she like me? Where is this going? How long is it going to last? Is it going to be great? I'm scared. You know, performance anxiety in every capacity. And what little Hans instructed Freud is this is an old conflict. that sexuality, that relational dynamics are fraught with anxiety. And even children who we used to think had this ideal little life are in great conflict between the roles they play with and between their parents. And they're worried about their father and what Freud called castration anxiety. If you're trying to compete with your father to win your mother in the Oedipal complex, you must realize at some point that your dad is big and you are small. And if you compete too aggressively, you're in danger. Okay? And so how young boys work through that is important. But it's inevitable that it's there. How young girls work through the identification with the mother and yet the competition with her for the father's attention. Ladies, isn't it true that it's that competition between women is vicious sometimes? Truth be told, quietly, when the guys aren't around, you admit it to each other. Where do you learn that, ladies? You learn it at your mother's footstep in competition with her for your father's attention. It's that intense, it's that primitive, and as adults, as adolescents, as teenagers, it's that dangerous. Okay. Sort of to summarize a little bit, Freud's idea of fantasy in this context, he began to see even more complexity. Do the children repress their aggressive propensities? Or are there sexual dynamics, libidinal dynamics, transformed into something else? He wasn't sure. It was complicated. Where does aggression go? Where does sexuality go in childhood development? Those questions, I think, are still being asked and answered at least tentatively even to this day. The last thing that Freud, I think, came out of the Little Hans case with is this idea of identification. And this you've got to get. Identification becomes a central issue in the structure of the human mind. How does one's ego become strong enough to manage the internal conflicts, to deal with reality? And Freud said, identification. That we take in experiences, loving experiences, nurturing experiences, strong, healthy maternal and paternal experiences of care and love and devotion. And in that matrix of paternal and maternal care, we identify with our strong and capable parents who give us an example to learn from. But more importantly, we, at a very unconscious level, take in their dynamics. It becomes our superego. It becomes our sense of identity, much more than just the superego. That's the vehicle by which the human mind is developed, according to Freud, at this early stage. That we, in experiences with our parents, don't just learn from them cognitively. We literally take in the fantasy of them inside of us. And that becomes, in a direct and powerful way, the very nature of our sense of selves in the world. Those experiences lay the foundation. And the last point is that it's not a linear development, I think, the way Freud initially thought. He thought that you went through the oral and anal and phallic, etc., and then if you were an adult and had mental illness, it was because you regressed all the way back. We don't think that way anymore. In Melanie Klein's way of thinking, we bring it all with us, that we accumulate experience. And the way I like to phrase it is, I don't really have to go very far to go crazy, because I pretty much brought crazy with me. I just got to go over here. That we all have the ability to become psychotic. We all have the ability to revert to more primitive ways of functioning. And the truth is, we do it all the time, in little ways. When you lose your temper, when you overreact, you're regressing to a primitive way of functioning. When you split, when you see somebody who's complex and you just think they're evil, that you're regressing to an old way of experiencing the world involving splitting and projection, we'll talk about later. So identification becomes the vehicle for Freud's development of the structure of the inner world, which Klein then takes and runs with. Freud thought of it as the earliest expression of an emotional tie to another person. Folks, here's the tie-in. This is so far beyond the mechanical model. Okay, everybody get that? That this way of thinking about identification, the Oedipus complex, human relationships taken in, and building the structure of self and identity, is just not anything at all like this mechanical dynamic model of an engine of the mind. All right. It really becomes a psychology based on relationships, on emotional meaning, on the way we handle anxiety and aggression and sexuality, but in the context of the sense of myself as a strong individual in the context of this internal object relational dynamic, most all of it unconscious and all of it profoundly powerful. All right, we'll take a break now and drive on with this material in the next couple of lectures. Thank you very much.